I'm going to talk about histolysis and its implications. When you retire from a situation at any level, gross physical, biomagnetic, psychological, spiritual, when you retire from it, you do so in order to come out of your retirement differently. And for that reason, I'm retired. And really, I shouldn't be out now because I've not finished my work. And as you know, when a caterpillar becomes a butterfly, it has to go into a state in between the two, and it mustn't come out until the work is finished, because it might conceivably spoil it. Now, I don't care about spoiling things, and as David would tell you, I frequently test things to distraction. That's because I'm a natural test pilot without owning a plane, so I have to sublimate in other ways. Now, the important thing about histolysis is this. Whilst the medical definition of it would mean the dissolution of organic structures, tissues, within an organism, it also has another, much deeper meaning. All the medical fraternity here tonight know perfectly well what medical histolysis is. I might call on my dear friend Arthur Berwitz for a technical definition. Arthur, histolysis, please. Oh, good. You're more enlightened. I'll ask Dr. Rogers then, shall I? Dr. Rogers, histolysis, what is it? Death of tissue. Well, we'll find another etymology for it, a little nearer the original base. It actually means the dissolution of the dividing walls that keep an organism in cellular condition. You know that when you have a fertilized egg, it proceeds to develop itself by putting partitions inside it. Because if it doesn't partition itself, it must remain a simple unity. And because of psychosomatic correspondence, it must have a simple, unific brain if it's only got a simple, unific body. To become more complicated mentally, we must become more complicated physically. So this process of histolysis means that all the cellular divisions which the one egg has made has to be broken down. You break the walls down inside, and the result is that you liquefy. You return into a protoplasmic jelly-like substance, something like I am right now, on the inside, held up only by your imagination. You might think that's funny, but it's your imagination that's keeping me in being, you see, because I would otherwise have departed. Now, the important thing is this. We start life not as a monocell in the seed, but as an energy field in a cosmic field of energy. Although the biologists, the experts, like David, what's his name, in This Is Your Life, Attenborough, that's right, yeah. Although he talks like a semi-Darwinian and would have life begin somewhere in the seas, long before the seas cooled on Earth, there was humidity in the atmosphere. And that humidity was sufficient base, not for life, because life is not the form that it makes. Life is eternal spirituality. Life is intelligence, life is conscious power, life is pure sentient energy. But it makes for itself vehicles, and these we call bodies. But it makes these bodies in anything whatever that becomes formulated. So if we were to strip ourselves of all our cellular divisions and of our skins, supposing we did this in this room now, supposing we broke down all our cells internally, break the cell walls down, and allow all the protoplasm to run into one colloidal mess, like somebody's forgotten the soap and left in the bath too long. You know that's like, don't you? Unless you're all well trained and never do that. I do it for fun. Imagine then, we also dissolve our skin surfaces, and we then all flow onto the floor. Can you imagine all these beings spread about on the floor as an indeterminate mass, colloidal, like a too wet piece of soap? Where would our individualities be then? Would we have any? Well, there's a room, don't wait too long, because somebody might offer you an answer to the question you put, and then you might have to debate it, so I'll carry on. At the protoplasmic level, there would be no individuality at all. There would simply be an ocean of vibratory sentient jelly. What individuality means is something higher than that. And before we come to consider what it is exactly, it is this individuality, I want to consider what it would be really like if we did strip ourselves of our differentiating cells and our skins and all flow together in one delightful gelatinous mass. And I put it to you this time, I want to reply from somebody. Would you like it? Why not? We'd be very, very matey. Nothing could be more intimate, could it? It would be more intimate than a sexual relation, wouldn't it? You'd have to define you then, wouldn't you? The you would be the whole mass, wouldn't it?
Well, the individual wouldn't be aware of it. Therefore, they, in a sense, they couldn't enjoy it as an individual.
They couldn't enjoy it as an individual. Well, let's say it would be very hard to do so. Very difficult. But now let's consider the origin of form. We're going to use the caterpillar into butterfly as an image. That word for soul, psyche, has relations which make some scholars say, really, it means butterfly. It was a symbol to the ancient Greeks of immortality, precisely because that caterpillar died inside a chrysalis and then emerged as a new being. And they said, by analogy, in the same way a human being might die and then emerge as a new being, able to fly. Now, the peculiar relation we have to consider is a threefold one. There are three stages: a larval stage, a pupal stage, and, if you like it in English, imago, imago, whichever you prefer, derived from the same word as image. A perfected formal stage, the third stage. Now, the larval stage is from a word meaning spectre, sort of ghost, related to the Latin lar for a household deity. I want you to think that the larval stage, like the caterpillar, is a primordial appetite, an appetite that has no other function but, in that stage, to stuff itself as much as it possibly can with food to get the energy. It eats in order to get the energy that it needs to make the transition from the appetival larval stage, the caterpillar, to the pupal stage. Pupal means one who is to learn. That's from a base P-U, poo, meaning to be able to emerge, to come forth. The pupa stage is the stage in which a primordial appetite, which is what we all are, if you ignore our cellular divisions, a primordial appetite is learning how to become a complete, ideated, structured, individuated being. Now, how can it do this unless there is a pattern? If that gelatinous mess on the carpet, namely our beings, with the cellular divisions removed, if that mass were the ultimate reality, there would be no possibility whatever of it developing into the truly individuated form that in fact it can and does become. So therefore, there is implicated another level of being, another level above or beyond, transcending that protoplasmic stage, that colloidal, gelatinous, soft, soapy phase. Now, this other level takes us immediately into the idea of the eidetic field. Now, by eidetic, we simply mean a very clearly defined idea structure. We know today, thank God for Einstein, the great popularizer, we know that matter is nothing but energy. And we know that energy means in work affirming. It is not doing nothing. Energy cannot do nothing. Energy is working. Now, if you imagine an infinitely extended energy at work, but lacking inertia, that is simply initiating continuously, repositing itself, imagine energy which is sentient. Imagine an infinite field of energy which is sentient, and because it is energy, it is working. Like that Jewish prophet Jesus of Nazareth said, "My Father works and I work." By his Father, he meant this infinite field of sentient power, who is the Father of every creature there is. So it's permissible to say, "My Father too." Jesus says, "My Father." We say, "Okay, and mine." And he says, "Good, realize it." Every prophet has said the same thing. There is a primordial power source for every being, and this primordial power source is called the Father. Father is simply a corrupt form of a word made of two parts, put here. Pater, Pater, Pitru, all those fundamental words mean to put here. Who put us here? Who put anybody here? Who put anybody here? Answer, energy did so. But the energy is sentient. The energy vibrates. There is no non-vibrating energy in the universe. Wherever science looks, it finds vibratory structures of energy. Imagine that science is deficient today only in one thing. It does not attribute sentience to energy. When it does so, it will solve a lot of problems, psychological and somatic. There is an infinite vibratory field of energy which, in its vibrations, structures itself. The vibrations interfere with each other. Now, the best image you can have of this is simply to stand with a bowl of water, or you can do it in the bath, and dip a finger into it or slap it or something. And you will see immediately, if you put one finger in, ripples go out from that finger. And they hit the sides of the bath or the bowl, and they are reflected back, and they intersect. And if you have a light, take a torch, not one connected to the mains, please, into the bath with you, and shine it, and you will see shadows on the floor of the bath thrown by the ripples that you make by putting your finger into the water. And dip your finger here and there, and watch the shadows, and you will see the evidence of a structured field. The evidence of a structured field. There is an infinite field of energy. This energy necessarily works eternally, because energy is by its very nature a worker. And in its working, it is self-stimulating to posit, like a finger dipping in itself. The word finger implies an end, a purpose, an aim, establishing gross matter. You've probably seen the picture of God creating Adam with his finger like this, haven't you? Michelangelo. You've also seen in medieval manuscripts, certainly, a hand coming out of a cloud with its index finger doing this. It's called the great interjection. It means within the infinite field of energy which constitutes our being, there is initiative. The energy is sentient. The energy puts its own finger into itself. It does it in a very simple way. An infinite field of energy can become initiative simply by contraction. The field contracts, and as it contracts like that, it makes a point. That point, and the driving radial forces into it, are the finger. The etymology of finger would give it to you. The fin in finger means end, and the gain it means earth, and the iron it means differentiation. A finger means a differentiating, finalizing, perfecting instrument. The finger of God is the thing which comes into the field which is infinite from the field itself, positing itself to make a point. Now all energy structuralizes itself in this way. And what we call protoplasm is not fundamental, it is a structure willed by this energy. The energy itself is basic. Sentient energy is the ultimate substance of reality. And this energy, by self-impressing, posits points. It posits an infinity of points because it's terribly fond of individuation. Because the alternative to individuation is splurging out in infinity, making no thing whatever. It has this alternative, it can actually undo all its points and lapse into a state in Hindu philosophy called pralaya, a laying down of itself into a passive condition in physics called maximum entropy. Now imagine that somehow mysteriously the ancient priest king scientists who thought very, very deeply about these things fabricated for themselves a word to symbolize this initiative. And what was the word? It was the word from which we derive the histo as a prefix in histology, the study of organic structures. The histo, and remember we changed from Greek to Latin, H into S, the histo becomes systo. And that systo is the origin of the word existence. Now, if you look in your dictionaries, if you still not sell them to defray expenses, if you look in them, you will find that that histo used as a prefix in histolysis is said to mean a web-like structure of tissue, organic tissues with a web-like structure. But it will then also tell you that at an earlier stage, this strange word meant the mast of a ship or the upright beam of a loom. And that was an esoteric statement by the priest. The upright beam of the loom and the mast of the ship was the phallus. But don't confuse the phallus with the little representative in the time process the men carry about with them. That one is only a very pale miniature reflect of the other. Phallus means Philolus means the light of logos reason. The light of logos reason. There are two kinds of reasons. Empirical reasons based on your external sense percepts, where you put things together if they're similar and keep them apart if they're different. That's a low kind of reason. A posteriori, the kind that scientists use to make sure that they're sure when they're sure. Another kind of reason they don't like is called a priori reasoning, which is reserved for very, very high philosophers if they stay sober, because it deals with logos. And remember that word logos is a Greek word meaning word and ratio, but not the ratio derived from the examination of external objective things. Not that ratio, because that is only a ratio of external forms. The kind of thing, a form must stay still in order to be measured. In which case you get steam, it's hard to measure. So you put it in a container, cool it and it becomes water, and you can then measure the dimensions of the container. But you can't take the water out of the container and keep its shape unless you first freeze it. Now we've all got fridges in these modern times, so we know we can get an ice cube, a definite amount of water, and we can measure its cubic capacity, so that we can actually say we are certain that we have a definite amount of water frozen in that cube. That is the kind of certainty that physical science is trying to establish for everything, including the human being. And that is the kind of certainty which leads them into mechanistic behaviorism. Because there is something about the human being that eludes this kind of distinction. We cannot freeze the human being. We can freeze his gelatinous chemically compound protoplasm, yes, We can keep him like that for a certain length of time and then warm him up again, like those necrophilic morgue attendants in America do, and observe he can still function. But when we try to measure a function, we are not dealing with a gross, frozen, rigid form at all. We are dealing with energy on the move. And when energy is on the move, it becomes an indeterminable. You know that you cannot find out the velocity and the location of a prime particle at the same moment. If you know its velocity, you don't know its position. If you know its position, you don't know its velocity. So here we have a straight condemnation of gross material empirical science in that it has an aim to reduce everything, including the human being, to the level where everything about it can be reduced to mechanics, and which is called mechanistic behaviorism, because they examine your external behavior by an external technique and then try to formulate through various mathematical devices an explanation that will guarantee that they have the power to predict your activity by the manipulation of a few mathematical equations, because you are a machine. But a machine has frozen parts, it has cogwheels, and so on. Now, supposing we say, well, let's refine the machine. Don't be satisfied with Stevenson's rocket. Let's modernize, let's start using electronic machinery. Is it machinery in the same sense? Answer, no, it is not. Because when we get an electrical machine, unfortunately for the gross materialist, for every wire with a current of electricity around it, there is an electromagnetic field that transcends the limitations of the wire. And these fields actually interfere with each other in a highly indeterminate way. And so subtle, so refined are they, that there is an inherent impossibility in deciding what they're going to do. Because if the experimenter, the scientist himself, decides to take part in the experiment, his own organism, which on his own hypothesis is an electromagnetic machine with some biochemical undertones, he is interfering with the experiment. So his objectivity disappears. He, the experimenting subjective being, is part of his own objective experiment. Therefore, he cannot win. He cannot reduce the universe, he cannot reduce living beings, he cannot reduce man to the level of a machine where he can predict it. Let's go back again to this little prefix, histo. The second half of the word, the lysis, is from a Greek word meaning loose, to loose. In the word dissolve and resolve and so on, you have the same base, say lu. Where put together and resolved. Lu, luere, means to pay for being loose, to pay for being loose. And the same root means game, as you see in Ludo. There are two kinds of behavior possible. One is loose behavior, and the other is controlled behavior. Now, the loose behavior, called in the Hindu system, ananda, or perfect bliss, infinite ocean of sentient power, with no restraints, fiddling about to no purpose, no end, no definition, no ultimate goal, just playing around, that's loose. Until that little finger comes and posits itself in the middle of it. And remember, that finger is nothing but the same energy that was playing loose, which has decided from within itself that loose behavior is not the only kind of behavior there is. There is an alternative to loose behavior, namely tight behavior. And with the pair of these behaviors, with tight and loose, put together, you have the phenomenon called life. Your blood is free to flow in your arteries. If you get a strong heart, you might even get as far as your capillaries and into your veins and back again. If you're not that strong, you probably perish. But wherever there is free flow in your body, it is permissible to say, let us call that Lu. But wherever in your body there is something tight, something rigid, something formed like your bones, then you have the antithesis to this dualic game. We are all made of loose tightnesses, tight loosenesses. Now supposing we examine this in terms of the ancient analysis of it, and say the symbol used by the ancients was the mast of a ship and the beam vertical of a loom, and by that they meant the phallic power of God. Not the tiddling about power of some little fellow trying to seduce a girl, but the actual foundation power of total reality. Phalanus, the logos, the light of reason. Not the outer reason of the empirical scientists, the true reason. Now we will talk about the true reason a little. The word logos is made from the same word forwards and backwards. You made log and you made go. You write log, L-O-G, and then write O-L, and then between two L's you have a hard G. Now L means to link, but in a persuasive way. It means to seduce. It means to lead along by the nose. Whereas the gamma, the L is a lambda, the gamma means to get hold of and condense and contract and make a ball of solid matter out of this very same energy. So if you wrote a lot of L's to represent a continuum of L, that would correspond with the concept of pralaya in Hinduism, the concept of maximum entropy or folding in of energy of physical science, and the concept of hell, that is to say, of total inhibition of capacities. There is no hell other than the inhibition of your talents so that you cannot develop. Not willed by you, but imposed on you. That is hell. To be impeded, to be frustrated is hell, and there is no other hell. Write that word with two L's and a hard G in the middle, L-O-G. G, as you know in geography, means earth, means compaction. Gamma means dark, compacted energy. Lambda means light. It means playing energy. It means loose, it means free. But these two energies, the lambda and the gamma, constitute this mysterious word logos, which is translated ratio or reason. The ratio of what? Not the ratio of external, empirically, scientifically determined physical material forms, because that's just a question of seeing whether the shape of this elephant's trunk is similar to another elephant's trunk. No, the ratio between L and G, the ratio of play energy to compacted energy. This is the longest. Your bones are gamma. Your intelligence is lambda. Between your intelligence and your bones, there is a hierarchy, a series of grades of relative unfreedom going down and down to final total unfreedom, the gamma. They used to mark that with a T in the ancient world to symbolize crucifixion. And they made that the last letter of the Hebrew alphabet to consolidate that idea. T. In the beginning, Alpha, and at the end, Tau. 18. Put them both together, it means the cosmic tree. Now imagine that we are all ultimately intelligence. And intelligence is structured sentience, pure knowingness of its own structure, and utterly without any of the gross heavinesses that we associate with matter. So that it can and does actually, although usually in the middle of the night when you go to sleep, change its mind. We're going to come to this problem of change, metamorphosis, in a few moments in relation to our historicism. The energy can and does change instantly. That is, instant by instant. He does not do it continually, because that is an impossible illogicality. All change is jump. All change involves anxiety. The A-N-G-E in change relates to that base root, angst, from which you get anxiety. Every change in our lives necessarily involves anxiety for this simple reason. When the caterpillar has eaten all the green leaves and stuffed itself with energy, it has to hide itself away from predators during the change. So it puts itself in a sheath called chrysalis. And that is from a Greek word, the same word from which you get Croesus, the richest man in the world, because it meant gold, like the Hebrew harus, gold. Because the colour, in general, of the case in which the pupa, the learner, is hiding to turn from larval stage into imago stage, to perfect its form, the colour of that case is golden yellow. I don't really examine many butterflies and moths and such like, but the general colour of most of them is towards that kind of colour. Now, it may be that that colour has to do with the way it intends to hide itself in a certain type of environment, because they have a technique of disguising themselves by changing colour so the predators won't eat them. But I want you to imagine the mere fact that a caterpillar, when it's eaten all it can eat until it's nearly bursting, comes to a certain period when it says, I cannot eat any more, and now I must have enough energy to make this metamorphosis, this change. In sleep, the morph, which is Greek for form, is also the Greek root for sleep, because you must sleep in order to make this change. Now imagine the caterpillar eats and eats and eats, and then it starts to make itself safe. Why does it? It hides under a leaf, or it puts itself in a funny coloured thing to merge with the background. It suspends itself in hidden places. If it did not think there was some danger, why should it bother to hide itself and disguise itself the way it does? Now, it knows that it could be eaten. And therefore, that period of change is necessarily a change equals an anxiety period. It must be in a state of tremendous anxiety, because some idiot might come and eat it just when it is about to become a butterfly. And you've seen the butterfly, no doubt, even if only on TV, when they first come out of that chrysalis state, their wings are all crumpled and they can't fly, can they? No. And therefore they could be eaten immediately by a little bird that's a bit hungry. So this passage in the threefold life, larval, pupil, imago, remember that word, imag, imagine, means I am appetite. Think about yourself seriously and ask yourself, what characteristic have you retained as long as you can remember, right back to the beginning of your childhood, to your babyhood if your memory is that good, or even prenatal if it's that good. What is your basic characteristic? And the answer is not that you were a communist all your life, or a Tory all your life, or a Presbyterian, or a Pentecostal Baptist. No, it is not in an idea that you are identical, it's in the one primordial fact that when you were in utero trying to grow yourself, that when you emerged at birth screaming and kicking, and when you bashed all the other kiddies in their cots around you into silence, appetite was the only mark of your being. Primordial appetite, and that is the marg in the imago. Primordial appetite, where does it come from? Your mother. It's a mar function. And without it, you could never become an individual. It is only by the appropriation of reality that you become an individual functioning at life level. Let's look again at this metamorphosis. The morph means form, and it means sleep. When you go to bed at night, you go to sleep, but you don't wake up the same person in the morning, Because relief from the pressure of external sense stimuli, hiding under your blankets, chrysalising yourself, you are actually rearranging your point of view about the world. It is not the same person that wakes up in the morning that went to sleep the night before. And it cannot be. Let us remember this vertical beam and do that little experiment. You blow air. What happens to the air that was idling when you blow air into air? Does the air that is there stay as it was? Disturbed. The term in disturb, in turba, means rotate. You make a column of air by going, and that air column is the human representative of the divine phallus. It is air, it is ruach. It is the origin of hierarchy, it is the origin of discriminative spirit. The ability to make a reflexive act and say, I will just demonstrate exactly what that histos means, that vertical beam. It is simply that column. You blow the column of air out, and the air that was idling there is thrown into turbulation. It must twist around the column unless the air was not idling. And that is tremendously important. If the air was idling, it cannot help rotating around the column when you blow it. But if the air there had already blown its own column, it could resist, could it not? If the air column coming out is spiraling out, which it does, like the water coming out of the tap, when you turn the tap on, it doesn't come out straight, it twists. The faster it twists, the more torque, T-O-R-Q-U-E, there is on it, the more resistance there is to interference by other rotating systems. What do we learn from this? A tremendously important thing. Only if we are busy are we safe from being interfered with by other busy bodies. The price of freedom is eternal vigilance, is it not? We have to be busy. I must be about my father's business, says that Jewish gentleman. Business. That implies self-encapsulation. The very word busy means encapsulated power, issuance, affirmation. That funny little word busy, read it backwards again, what do you get? What do you get from busy? Yeah? You've actually got the word Jesus plus house in busy. Yes. Now it actually means what he says. Now that word Jesus only means this. It does not refer simply to a man that lived a long time ago in Nazareth. It refers to any person, there's a lot of them in Spain now called Jesus, any person who comprehends that the meaning of his life is this, affirmation saves. Remember Spinoza? Adequate knowledge equals activity equals happiness. Inadequate knowledge equals passivity equals misery. If you allow yourself to become passive and somebody else is not passive, they will turbulate your sentient power for you in the way that they determine. Like, say, the Leninists in Russia did for people who thought they were going to enjoy a commune, and now they can have electric shock treatment every time they disagree with the government. A handful of beings who have known this truth from the beginning of human civilization have controlled the human race by a little device. A very small device, this one. The Latin base, lingua, the Sanskrit base, lingam, means phallus. It means this primordial driving power which ties people up. That lingua is a linker. It ties ideas together, doesn't it? A word. Doesn't a word tie an idea to another idea? If I say cat, don't you tend to think of dog? Or do you think of cat and nine tails, a whip? It might be that you can make people think about the cat and nine tails by mentioning a chihuahua. If you make the poetic links between, you can do it. So the peculiar thing is that vocabulary, the manipulation of that little lingua there, is the determiner of your own thought. If you allow yourself to get a vocabulary at all, and you don't break your vocabulary down to its basic elements, then you become a servant of the vocabulary. Therefore, you are required, if you like freedom, to comprehend the meaning of the terms you use, to liberate yourself from the usage of other beings who actually fabricated that language. When the State of Israel was first formed, one of the earliest organizations in it was an Institute for Language Control. Because if they control language, they control ideas. If they control ideas, they control emotions. If they control emotions, they can control those movements which you erroneously call acts of will, but which are not acts of will, but only acts of conation, of reactive drive. Until you get hold of your vocabulary, your idea, your own emotion. Now, we said at the beginning, we're talking about this histolytic process, this process whereby a structure, an organic structure, is loosened. And we're going to remind ourselves of our symbolic ladder. You could have a gross material protoplasmic loosening, as for instance, you could put a under an x-ray machine too often a person to be x-rayed for a disease and kill them with the x-rays. That would be histolytic too. You'd be loosening them up by bombarding them with the x-rays. That's one way. Gross material dissolution. It happens, of course, when an organ changes its form in the evolution from egg into fully developed human being. But it also happens in another way. You have an emotional finger, the biofield finger, your ring finger, little finger for gross material body, ring finger for the biofield, like and dislike. Your likes and dislikes are also structured. And unless you learn to change your likes and dislikes, that is, go through this histolytic process, you are bound by your likes and dislikes. Did you decide as a child what to like and what to dislike? Or did your parents do it to me? I saw last year a mama and a papa with a baby crying bitterly at table because it didn't like to eat meat. But it had to eat meat because mama and papa eat meat and it's very, very good for them. The baby was crying and vomiting it out and spitting it on the plate and they were putting it back in the mouth and hitting the baby. It was developing what is called an acquired taste. I had the same trouble with mushrooms as a small boy myself. Mushrooms and a cheese called Roquefort. Now, when a baby doesn't want something, it really doesn't want it because it's contrary to the baby's structure. Not its gross material structure, its mentational structure. There is something in that child that is inherently structured before it gets itself the gross body, which is the chemistry given to it by the mother eating while the child is in utero. The mother's diet is influencing the child, but the child may not like it. Somebody may give me something out of the kindness of their heart, like a biscuit which I don't eat, made out of whale fat, and within 10 seconds it's on my cheek in the form of a red blob. Usually I put my finger on it and I say, would you mind using the proper exit, please? And then it goes away. But the economic tendency is, if you eat something that your internal structure thoroughly dislikes, you throw it out, have a rash. You know, you can get big rashes across your tummy here and show them to people, you see, keep them at bay. You can do all kinds of things. If you don't like somebody, you can rash at them. When they rash at you, you rash at them. cools that out. Now, if we accept this histolytic process must be undergone to change anything, to change your physical body, to change your emotional attitude, to change your serial mode of mental thinking, to change your governing concept in life, to change your will, your orientation of will within the universe, to change your overlooking way, the way you look from above on the whole system. All those changes involve anxiety at every level, because you might be interfered with. When I was a small boy, I was doing my dying exercises, my anticipatory deaths at home. My mother always made me lock the bedroom door, because I looked so awful that my little sisters used to cry and go rushing out and say there's something wrong with me. And I was only practicing dying. So my mother insisted that I lock the bedroom door. You couldn't really guess that, could you? Not unless you fiddled about a bit cheekily beforehand. Mm-hmm. It'd be difficult. And yet, somebody wondered whether a spider might appear. Mm-hmm. That was a psychological trick, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. Really?
Yeah.
Just get a straight line pattern that doesn't look like spiders, and then look as if a spider might appear. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then somebody says, maybe he's got a spider there, and we're not quite sure about this pattern. Mm-hmm. There is that tendency mm-hmm. in the mind. I've got into a habit of that since, locking bedroom doors. It's the only safe way to avoid a predator rushing in and doing something to you, like giving you artificial respiration when you're right in the middle of your best meditation. They can even stick needles in you, you know. There's a very large muscle here that nature provided for putting needles in to wake you up and bring you back to what is called social normal behavior. That means you're ready to go back to work without increase of pay, without regard to the galloping rate of inflation and so on. If you do that, you're a good citizen. Now, every level that you change, and you have to change whether you like it or not, because there is an energy, namely the top energy of the universe. The symbol for that energy is, in English, the letter A. It's Alpha in Greek and Aleph in Hebrew. There is a universal power pushing to make individuals individuate, whether they like it or not. And it does not care in any way what they suffer, what they undergo, providing they individuate. And it doesn't care if it kills you in the process, because gross material death is not very important anyway. What is really important is that the original structure of the energy field, long before the low levels of protoplasm appear, the original structure of that energy field is individuated, which means that every one of us is already an eternal monad, a being, a one being, a lord, ad, of its own self, a monad, a one lord to itself. Everybody is a one lord to their own being in that structured field of energy, the Ruach, that Aleph power, that capital A. And that throws a very heavy responsibility on us, because that universal power is pushing us like mad to individuate, to become unique, to develop our talents, against another force which is called Mammon, the force of this world, this gross world. You cannot serve God equals free spirit, and Mammon equals material counting. Because if you are governed by Mammon, your aim is not change, it's not metamorphosis, it's not that histolytic breakdown and then the rebuilding of a new being, it is that horrible thing, comfort, at the gross material level. Those are two possibilities. Three initiatives, exact opposite, is gross material comfort. You know what we're moving towards? In electronic science, we're moving towards a house which as you drive up in your car, the car itself being electronically controlled, all you're required to do is not touch it with your finger, no. Too much energy for that. You look at it. You actually have on the steering wheel a panel with buttons on, and you just look at the button that says home, and it selects it. Don't think that's far away. It's not. It's very, very near. We've got all the technology to do it. It's only vested interests of silly old-fashioned petrol car people and things like that that hold it back. We have the technical knowledge to do that now. And when you come home in this way, the car drives into a garage and up and over the door like that. And what do you think happens next? The car unfolds. And a grab comes down very gently and picks you up and goes like this. And sits you at the table, you see. And if you remember Charlie Chaplin in the Modern Times, they had a feeding machine so he didn't need to stop work. You remember it? Well, you'll be able to look at a sausage and mash or whatever, and it'll come into you like this vibrating. You only open your mouth because there's a magnet under your chin. Fastened at birth, and it alternates like this. You don't need to do anything. Would you like one of those, Eric? I hope so. Now, consider. This is the ideal of gross material science. It has been seriously worked upon today by the best electronic engineers. And they're going to do it. You can't stop them. Because to every concept, there is an opposite concept. And the opposite of eternal free initiative is perfect mechanism. And the same amount of energy that has to move you towards perfect freedom must necessarily, logologically, provide you with the temptation to make sure you don't want it. Because if you want a thing, you are not free. You can only do a free act if you do not want. An act of will is not a want, it's not a wish, it's not a desire. It is an initiative out of nothing. Imagine an initiative that comes out of no formal stimulus. It just wells up from the centre. It's a new act. It's a new positing of a new emergence, something that was never there before. And it has nothing whatever to do with gross material comfort. And it doesn't care about gross material comfort. But then, says gross material comfort, I don't care about you. Now, these are two sides of the same cosmic power. The same cosmic power is offering you freedom and tempting you, disguised as the devil, with eternal comfort. What a terrible opposition. Now, every time you go to one of these changes, you go into an anxiety state. Let's take just a few. When the sperm attacks the ovum, what guarantees that it will want to get there? Answer, millions of other sperms. I mean, imagine one sperm released and an egg there with no shield around it, no thick mucus protective barrier. And the egg is saying, this way, please, and opening the door. Can you imagine that sperm? No rivals. One sperm and a finger going, this way, dear. Does it hurry up? No. All those sperms are there to make any one of them make its mind up to go. Rivalry is a device to trick the sperm into thinking, my God, this must be important. Look at all these fellas going there. You know, once I nearly got swept into a football ground. You know, it was a mess of people. They took me and the car with them. There were so many of them. I nearly cut into a football match. That would have been terrible for me. I went to a football match once, willfully, to see what it was like. I was 14 years of age. And it was a November day, and it was terribly cold. And it was horrible. You couldn't see the field for the fog. And there's a poor fellow there with bronchitis selling chest tablets. I was sure they didn't work. They weren't doing him any good. So half time I left. I daren't leave beforehand because they'd have beaten me to pulp if they'd have tried. this mass of sperms is there to make any single one of them deluded into thinking that because all of them are going there, it must be important. It's a canny device to make sure that impregnation occurs. Now that's an anxiety situation, and eventually it sits inside the egg, and well, it's what the devil is doing there. What do you do when you're in an egg? The answer is eat it, isn't it? So this little sperm fella starts eating up as fast as he can. I must have come here for something, there's nothing to do, so I'll eat. You notice it when you've got nothing to do, you start eating, don't you? Yes, trying to keep your figure down when you've got nothing to do is very awful. Because you have to do something, and you tend to repeat the old story. And then you go through various changes embryonically. Then you come to be born, that's a terrible thing. You've been in perfect comfort, curled up here, everything laid on to the navel, no efforts. Occasionally give a kick like that to let mummy know that you're there so she does not sit in an uncomfortable position for you. I'm not joking, babies actually think like this, you know. You think she's been on the right side too long for my comfort, so they go, boing, and she has to move. The price that women pay for allowing themselves to be impregnated is absolutely colossal. They wouldn't do it if they could think, actually, so God has provided them with a sort of insulator against thought. Anyhow, then it's got to get born. It's got to have that poor head, great big head, actually. Even on a little girl, there's a big head. Have you noticed that? I bet if you got the littlest girl in this room and measured her head, it's as big as the biggest head that is in the room. Give or take a thousandth of a centimetre. This head has got to be crushed to go out to a gate. How do you think it feels from perfect comfort to go out there, trailing this tube of oxygen and food supply? It doesn't like it. But then some convulsions start going, Mama's had enough of you, get out. I wish to gladnackers about you. I want to show you off to my neighbours and what a good child you are, how beautiful, how intelligent, how just like me. So the poor thing gets kicked out. And that's another metamorphosis, isn't it? From an intrauterine, perfectly protected being, it's flung into the outer world, and it now has to get its first breath. Oxygen burns you. It's horrible stuff, oxygen, until you get used to it. It has a really rough time in that birth process. Even if you try your best to relax and so on, it's still got the fact that it's got to take its own breath. And that breath point is very important, because from the moment it breathes its own breath, it has taken a tremendous jump into individuation and the first stage of a real separation from its mother. In utero, it couldn't think or feel differently from its mother properly because of the biochemical substances synthesized by the mother and put into the child. So it was not a true individual. It was trying to be, but the mother dominated it in utero. Gets pushed out, takes its first breath. Now it's on its own. That's tremendously dangerous. Being born is a dangerous time, and yet you have to be born in order to be individuated. The seed has got to fall to the ground and die, because the process of mitosis in the egg is a kind of death, and the sperm has to die a death in the egg so that the child may be born. And then the child grows up progressively, and it reaches another horrible stage, puberty. That's that same base poo to have the power to cause an emergent. Something's going to happen. The puerilities, puberty, another time of anxiety. There's a strange force, and the new chemistry being synthesized in that child. And the child may feel so awful it may turn back to the parents for protection. Turn back to daddy if it's a little girl. Don't let me grow up. You'll be my daddy forever. Or if it's a little boy, go to mummy and say, you will be my mummy forever, won't you? And mummy will say, probably, yes, dear. She might not be thinking about what she's saying, but it's highly probable that through ancestral inertia, she will say it. Puberty is a tremendously dangerous time. You know what dementia praecox is? schizophrenia that comes to you when you pass through puberty. It's when you have to stop being a dependent being. You've already had your first go by taking your first breath. And now you've got to leave your mother and father, and you've got to go out and become a mother and father, or both or neither, by your own efforts. You've got to try to establish a life of your own, a family of your own, on your own territory. And this is a tremendously damaging thing. Very dangerous. And again, you have to go to sleep to do it. Your chemistry goes to sleep. You're probably becoming spotty because of the chemical changes that occur at that time. And I've seen a lot of kiddies at that stage covered all over in horrible spots, unable to get a boy or a girl because of it, crying. I've seen them even suicidal, covered in spots, because no boy would kiss such spotty faces. It's all the chemistry of change and a condition of anxiety necessarily there. And then they get through that, and then they grow up a bit more, and they get married, and they start growing up. Then they come to another thing, which is even worse than being born. And that is the first shadow of death. The menopause in women, and the womanopause in men, which occurs... It actually occurs when the waitress in the restaurant says, "What do you want today, Grandad?" It's true. There are two very well-known fellows down there, both of them very well-known in the field they're on. They rang me up one day, and they were both crying on the phone. I thought they were drunk. And they said, "We're not drunk, we're not drunk. We've both had the same nightmare," and I had to go to town to see them. And I went there, and they were sitting there trying to drink coffee, and they couldn't. They'd both dreamed the same dream. They'd both dreamed that same night that they were impotent. This was the end. And horror of horrors, the waitress had said, "Well, Grandad, what would you like today?" Now, my only way of curing them at that time was to send one back to his wife, because she didn't dislike him that much, and the other was to give a girl to the poor other fellow who couldn't get his own. So I said to a particular girl who was at a loose end and looking for her husband, "How would you like to do this job? Here's a fellow who's had a dream that he's impotent. Would you like to test him out and see if the dream is prognosis or not?" And she was very, very glad, and she jumped on the job, and she saved his life for about 3 years, and he dropped dead. Now, this menopausal thing in women is tremendously horrible, and what we have to remember is this metamorphosis must occur throughout life. You'll have another one when you die. I mean, when you've gone through the menopause, you don't care if you do die, usually. I know I didn't. It seems at that point that life is meaningless. What do you do next? Wait for the grave? Now, with each change, with each metamorphosis that you make in life, you have to have a reorientation. And you can only get that reorientation by very, very careful setting before you go to sleep a real question: what is my next direction? What is my next orientation? I must know where I'm going. What am I going to do? Am I going to go negative on my life and say, "I can't breed any more children, therefore I'm useless, give me a stone and beat my brains out, I'm finished"? Or am I going to say, "What was all that rubbish malarkey about getting married and having children and bringing them up to say rude words to me when they've come back from Oxford and things like that? I've been deluded. I've been used by the moon to populate the earth, to make more bodies, for more experiences, for that Olive Pusher fella who's busy individuating, and he can't individuate without bodies, and I'm so dumb I didn't know that at the time, so I made some for him in my innocence, because he, canny fellow, had made it enjoyable to make them. I've been trapped with my likes and dislikes. I now have to change my likes and dislikes. I need a new set of likes and dislikes, and I need those at the menopause. Men get it slightly later, statistically, perhaps 10 years later. But they get it. And they very, very often become deeply depressed when they think that the sexual energies in them, which they fondly imagined were their own and were not, have gone away and left them meaninglessly there with no possibility of seducing anybody or fouling things, no go, no positivity, and the terrible consciousness of a generation gap. A generation gap means that the girls actually don't think about you anymore, they've given you up. Oh, did 'em. Now, the only way to get through any one of these crisis periods is by conscious, deliberate reorientation. This is why my friend Fred Freeman has been working for some years on an idea to get rid of this silly attitude of retiring from the world at a certain age and start a new life campaign. Instead of having a wait for death process, have a new creative life. And I don't mean playing bingo to while away the time. I mean actually to start creating in a totally new way. There are many, many creative talents that everybody has, and they've not the faintest idea they've got them, because they've been trapped into a biological evolute necessity for the time being. But when they've seen through that, which they won't see through until they reach menopausal stage, when they've seen through it, instead of giving up and saying, oh, my life is finished, it is time now to say, now my own personal integrational work begins. Now I have to make myself really myself, and not to be a servant of biology. I can still afford to wave kindly to my progeny as they're working for me hard, digging in the gardens or working at business and giving me their profits. I'll smile on them for that and let them carry on with their illusions. But certainly I must have a directive of my own. You don't have to wait. It's just that you tend to wait. Now this is a very important thing. Margarita has raised this point. Why do you have to wait? You don't. But you know that it has been in the interest of government for 6,000 years recorded history to keep as many people as possible in the dark about the nature of initiative. That word king and Cain, the murderer of Abel, are two sides of one coin. You know, you've all been taught, those of you that have any Semitic or Christian background, that Cain murdered Abel, therefore Cain was a bad boy, haven't you? Isn't that so? Any Christians in the audience? Or any Jews in the audience? Were you taught that Cain murdered Abel? Did you think that was a bad thing or a good thing? Weren't you taught that it was a bad thing? Very interesting. Yet the word Cain means intelligence of God. It gets rid of Abel right at the start for a very simple reason. Abel is Adel. It means God is my father. Abel knows too soon that he can rely on his father. You know what that is like? It means he won't work. He will do an act of faith, won't he? And it is too soon at the beginning of evolution to have that faith, isn't it? Is it? Am I alone? Do I think we should have that faith at the beginning? And if so, why did the Creator put the serpent in the garden? Was it there for nothing, or decoration, or temptation? Because Adam was free to make his own mind up, such as it was, a non-experienced, innocent mind. He could have carried on doing what he was told. But would he have individuated? Answer, no. He would have been merely the voice through which God spoke, merely the body which obeyed without question God. And there would have been no opposition to God, only continuous obedience. Pardon? Well, his body has been made of earth, dust of the ground, yeah? Very, very fine, much finer than animal bodies. But it has not resisted, has it? Up to the time that Eve misleads him, it hasn't resisted. Now, supposing I blow this aircon, but you, very cleverly by your magic art, as I blow, remove all the air around it. What happens to the aircon? Disperses. It dissipates. It loses individuation, doesn't it? So, opposition is essential for individuation. You must have a back EMF. You must have a force generated by your own force pushing back on you to force you into individuation. Otherwise, you could be a very good boy, absolutely. But you would not be an individuated good boy in the sense that we're talking about, would you? No, wouldn't be possible. And therefore, this mysterious so-called fall of Lucifer and this fall of Adam, this giving into the temptation, is a necessary part of the evolutionary process whereby individuation appears in the universe. And that individuation is a weapon against infinite lazy. What we call eternal bliss is only lazy. And in that is total dissipation. And therefore that same energy, which is itself that dissipating energy, gathered itself together and made universe. It made one big turn, a cosmos, and it made that big turn as a self-encapsulation to provide itself with a wall which, when the energy was initiated from the centre, would go out, beat on the wall, and come back and hit the centre and make individuation. Without the letter B, the second letter of the alphabet, which means a house, a dwelling, an encapsulation, there could be no containing of that energy. There could be no reflection from the walls of the container back onto the centre. There could be no individuation. Hence, AB equals Father. Yeah? And BA, the same thing. Saying Abba is like saying Daddy. Back to you, Dad. And then the third letter is a hard gimel, compaction. Once you've encapsulated yourself, the vague idea, I think I must be an individual, vaguely, the next thing is to apply yourself as hard as you can in the physical world with full consciousness upon that fact, without waiting. We don't need to wait, actually, absolutely. Before we enter the physical universe, we didn't really need to enter it if we had had the reflexive power to turn the energy back on itself without coming into this universe. But do you know what would have happened then to us? Each energy that did that would have made itself into a universe. If it reflected its own energy back onto itself, it would make a universe. And that's why the astronomers have to talk about universes plural. Because this process doesn't just happen in one place, it happens an infinity of times in an infinity of places, all by self-precipitation. So there is this tremendous infinite intent to individuate, and she's saying, you don't need to wait for me to do it, you can do it, if, capital I, capital F, if you've got the energy, and you need energy to do it, even if you got it out of fried tomatoes, it doesn't matter where you get it from. If you've got the energy to make a reflexive act and say, thus far have I come, and now I know that I am being forced to individuate by an unconquerable power. I cannot defeat the infinite in its intent to individuate me. I can make myself miserable by trying not to be individual, trying to be a member of the mob, a member of the crowd, a member of society, a member of this, that and the other comfy, loving, diners clubbery group. But whatever you do, that universal energy is forcing you more and more and more to individuate. And when you know that, then you conquer time. You say, okay, I'm an individual. The infinite is determining me to be an individual. I'm going to stop kicking against it. So I might have to say to my companions everywhere, sorry, I'm busy individuating at the moment. And they'll say, what a rotten type you are. You haven't had a double whiskey for weeks. and they'll not invite you to their next barbecue. And then you have to face that, because everything costs something. But if you once say, like Margaret says, why wait? There she is, she's a married woman. You're not divorced, so how do you get out? Not yet, no. And you won't do that, will you? At least if you are doing that, you know when. She is a conscious creature. You only have to look at her shape to know that she's a natural individuator. And it's because of that mysterious fact that she tied herself to another natural individuator, Gerhardt, so the two of them could do this to increase their individuation. Actually, they don't spend, you don't mind if I tell you a life story very shortly, do you? They don't spend most of their time wheedling each other into comfort, do you? Right? No. And if you did, it'd be very bad for your individuality. But that's no excuse for your behavior tonight when you go home. Is it? You see, the spirit, which is conscious energy, is very quick. He could chalk one up and then hit her tonight when he goes home and say, he's merely obeying my individuation orientation exercise. You have my full permission, if he does that, to say, I will psych my response immediately. You don't have to wait, Margaret, for anything. The tendency, because you have been trained on a scheme laid down by priest king scientists long ago to be a slave. Slave means one who does the washing up, actually. That lathe in slave. Whether you start with feet and work your way up, like Jesus with Peter. Socrates said it very simply when he said, if we had not got hewers of wood and drawers of water, we would not have time to think about philosophy. So therefore, this handful of bright sparks, these Canish intelligences, said, let us teach, let us devise an educational system that will make virtue out of slavery for everyone, except us. Now they've done it for 6,000 years in a published form. True, they put it symbolically and in myth, but they have done it, and it is there in mythology. Mythology is nothing but science disguised with a total way of living, illustrated in myths of heroes and dragons and so on. When you hear that word dragon, do you think as a small boy, it's mainly two words, dragon, which means a discriminating being. It doesn't mean anything else. A dragon is a discriminating being. And the obvious thing to do is frighten people who might start to be discriminating by telling the other people that they are dragons without giving them a definition. They're dragons. Kill dragons. All dragons have to be killed, you know. It's a rule. Dragon killing is a rule. Who said that? Signor. Greek for earth digger. When we look seriously at our own lives, do we not have to confess that from the moment that we were extruded, ignoring the intrauterine education, the moment we were extruded from the mother, we were hammered into shape by parents and educators of all kinds, and the whole movement of ourselves towards our unique individuation potential was effectively destroyed. Now, destroyed means two laws. The death, Troy. Troy means affirmation of a law. Destroyed means they give you another idea than the true idea, and that confuses you. You know perfectly well that you are supposed, by your own inherency, to develop whatever talent you got to the most fantastic extent of performance. You know that you're supposed to do that. You can feel it inside yourself. But your education said that's very naughty of you and very selfish and antisocial, and you mustn't do it. In any case, it increases the spread of syphilis and gonorrhea and things like that. So don't do it. Now, it's true that loose behavior can result in various kinds of discomfort to the unintelligent. But you don't have to be unintelligent, because in fact, your intelligence is a locus of the infinite intelligence called God. And we see shortly what we're talking about. Caterpillars into butterflies. The caterpillar, a larval stage, pure appetite. Think of yourself as an appetite with an infinity of possibilities of food and an infinity of possibilities of enjoyment and of indigestion. These are the facts, because whatever you eat is energy. The energy is structured, and when you take a meal, the energy might eat you. And then you call that indigestion. And it's a real fight between your being and the ingested being. They are both energies. And yet you have to do this. You have to take in this energy. You are driven to do so by a primordial appetite, which makes you in a larval state. And then, when you've eaten enough, at the gross level, you know when you've eaten enough because you feel tight down here. At the mental level, when you start taking in ideas, you reach a certain saturation level in which your mind won't take any more ideas in it. So then you're ready for a mental sleep, and you become a pupa. The word as Latin means a girl, a doll, a puppet. But it's from a base meaning. Power is emerging from it in a new form. You put yourself, when you've eaten your mental food, your concepts, your ideas, then you take all these and you put yourself to sleep. And you know that these ideas, because they're energies, they must attain an equilibrium of their own. They can't help it, because the energies fight. Herbartian psychology is possibly one of the simplest explanations of that. The last century, the ideas, the concepts that you've imbibed fight inside you, and your best condition for that fight is to be asleep. You are then wrapped in a golden cover, a sheath, a chrysalis. Gold because it is your will. It is your will to change in sleep that determines. When you go to bed at night, tell yourself, I'm going to sleep to change my mind. Don't omit to say that. The last thing you say, the last subject in your mind before you go to sleep, determines the general orientation of your sleeping research. So you say to yourself deliberately, I am going to sleep to change. I'm going to become another being in the morning. Say it, know that it's true because it is, and then commit yourself into that state. You are a pupil, same root, pupa, a student, a learner. You've taken in your ideas. Only in sleep, when you've suspended the ideas of your waking state, only in that sleep can you reorientate the real ideas that you have absorbed and put them into a pattern that you did not have before, and guarantee that in the morning you wake up a different person. I mean a different person, because the word person, perason, through Sander, means a new rationale. You still recognize yourself, of course, because you have a memory. But you will remember that what you thought yesterday isn't quite what you're thinking today. You have a new orientation, and then you'll become the imago, that perfected being. And every morning when you wake up, you'll be another perfected being than the perfected being you were the morning before. And as you develop full confidence in this metamorphic process, as you are prepared to abandon yourself to this histolysis, you know that there is a ship's mast there, the vertical beam of that supreme power that we call God, that is saying, while you are asleep, I, the God of gods, am modeling you in the way I want you to go towards individuation. Remember, God is on your side when you individuate. And the devil is there to stop you and make you satisfied with mammon-like comforts. Don't omit to do that. Don't think it's just a vague idea. It's a very powerful determinant and orientation of consciousness that when you go to bed at night with supreme confidence, you know for a fact, as soon as you think about it, that the one that wakes up in the morning is not the one that went to sleep last night, because there has been a change, an orientation. The pattern is not as it was. The person is new. There's a new through sounder. And every night that you go to sleep like that, your confidence increasing, you will have more work done for you by that infinite power than your empirical external ego could ever do for you. No, that would be an. Don't do that. God knows where you go. The infinite field knows the direction of your orientation. Your empirical ego does not. So don't you decide whether you're going to be a new Michelangelo playing Chopin like Paganini. Just you know that that beam is gone, and it is the axis of your beam. It's running up and down your spinal cord, which is Jacob's ladder. Messages are ascending and descending like angels up and down your spine. Your empirical ego does not determine them and cannot do so. But the moment you say to yourself, I know in principle there must be that individuating power, because I'm a lazy fellow and I don't individuate easily. Driven towards individuation. Okay, I give in individuating. And you know where I'm going. The empirical ego does not. Then you can rest easily. And if you thought the empirical ego had to do it, the empirical ego would not go to sleep. It would try to retain control all night long. And then it would not be asleep and it couldn't go through the metamorphosis.